This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out. Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in Middle Eastern Studies, a podcast channel on the New Books Network. I'm Amir Sayyad Abdi, the host of the channel. Today, I have the pleasure of talking to Dr. Hossein Banoi about his new book, Hidden Liberalism, Burdened Visions of Progress in Modern Iran, which was published in 2020 by Cambridge University Press. Dr. Banoi is an associate professor of international studies in the Hamilton Lugar School of Global and International Studies at Indiana University, Bloomington, and also research affiliate at the Center for International Studies at MIT. Dr. Banoi, Hossein John, if I may, thanks for accepting my invitation and welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. It's wonderful to be with you.
To start off, Hossein, could you please tell us a bit about your personal and research background and also, you know, what kind of research you are interested in and have been working on?
Sure. Well, I should say, since this is a book on Iran, I am Iranian by birth. I was born and raised in Iran until I was about 15 years old, grew up in Tehran. So I completed my elementary and secondary middle school education in Iran. I started high school in Canada. And then after I was 15, my family and I moved to Toronto in Canada. I went to high school there and then university at York University, where I studied political science and specialized in both international studies and political philosophy. And then after that, I did my master's in international relations at the London School of Economics in London. And it became clear after I did my master's that I was really interested in international theory, political theory. Those subfields were still really pulling on me. So when I started my doctoral studies at Brown University, I continued with political theory as my primary field and then international relations as my secondary field. Throughout all my studies and in my dissertation work, I have really focused on Iran from both an intellectual history perspective, but also in terms of contemporary topics as well. So my research interests are at the intersection of international relations and political theory, with special interests in topics in democratic theory, in liberalism in non-Western settings, human rights, as well as diplomatic history, and specifically on U.S.-Iran relations. One hat that I wear, the other hat that I wear, I should say, in international relations is really linked to this 15-year project I've been a co-convener on, U.S.-Iran relations, which has been jointly based out of MIT, Brown, and now at Indiana University with two of my colleagues there. So the other books I've published are co-authored by collaborators based out of those institutions. But throughout this period, I've also maintained an interest in political development of Iran, especially from the standpoint of political theory. And this book really came out of that interest primarily.
Mm. I mean, is that the only story behind the book, or is there something more?
Well, the specific story behind the book has to do with my interest in graduate school. When I was doing my doctoral work, I was reading the kind of canonical works in liberal political theory, which were really in vogue in the American Academy, especially. You can't really do a political theory course in a mainstream program at an American university without getting a thorough education in John Rawls, for instance, and in the canon of liberal political thought. And especially since my dissertation focused on this kind of puzzle of democracy in Iran, my dissertation was about contextualizing the struggle for democratic governance in Iran from the late 19th century all the way to the late 20th century. In the course of that research, I really became interested in how the language that was employed in Western liberal political theory seemed to completely discount the presence, a real practice of liberal political thought in non-Western settings. It was either ignorant of it or it did not have the linguistic capabilities to be able to read the primary literature in those fields. And so after I finished my dissertation and I was thinking about turning it into a book, it became clear to me that actually all along, instead of democracy, I had been thinking about liberalism in the Iranian context. And especially how absent what seemed to be so substantively present in during the course of Iran's political development, how absent it was linguistically, even in the works of Iranian political thinkers and politicians. And so I really became curious about why is it that liberalism is such a different standing in non-Western settings, and especially the non-Western setting that I was most familiar with, Iran. And that really launched me into this project of trying to figure out why it was that liberalism, arguably the most successful ideology of the, especially second half of the 20th century in the world, in the West, seemed to have very little resonance or at least public acknowledgement in the non-Western world, especially at the same time as other ideologies such as, you know, socialism, communism, nationalism, varieties of royalism seem to be present, that also had presence in Western societies as well. Liberalism always stood out to me as something that was really understudied in non-Western contexts. And that inquiry really launched the interest in this book and eventually what it became, Hidden Liberalism.
Mm. I want to follow up on a couple of points there, but let's start with the most obvious question, the title of the book, Hidden Liberalism, which very efficiently sums up your main argument, at least as I understand it. But before getting into those points and before talking about the context of Iran specifically, could you tell us how do you define liberalism? I mean, what is liberalism and what is hidden about it?
Yeah, very good question. I struggled with that very same question at the starting point of my inquiry because liberalism just seemed such a vast subject matter, such a vast intellectual terrain, and getting a handle on it was very difficult. It can still be very difficult. And I was lucky in a sense that at the time that I was contemplating this, there were a series of other inquiries by Western political theorists, mainly people like Duncan Bell, for instance, or Michael Frieden, who had written on liberal languages and genealogies of liberalism, were also trying to pin down what would be the essence of the liberalism as an intellectual project, but also specifically as a political and moral project. And as I was reading that literature and I was trying to kind of arrive at a kind of a clear understanding myself, it became clear to me that I really identify with, especially the work of Duncan Bell in his now very famous article, What is Liberalism?, in which he basically pitches liberalism as a very big tent ideology that contains a variety of different languages. It responds to different contexts differently. And yet it has a kind of a discernible common substance. And that substance really boils down to a preference for unencumbered self-expression, individuality, a preference for toleration, a prizing of reason over the passions, very broadly understood, as well as constitutional government, a government that is has certain limits placed on it that are meant to really preserve individual liberty and the principle of equal respect for human dignity, for instance. So that common essence is something that liberals share universally, but the language in which they express it, the struggles in which they engage to realize those preferences into specific laws in particular contexts differ and look different in different settings. What struck me about liberalism conceived of that way is that it is far from a kind of a universal rational project, especially in the manner in which Western political theorists have oftentimes taken it for granted to be. And I wanted to really push back in this book by offering this other mode of liberalism that I call hidden liberalism, that has a different language, a different set of practices in modern Iran.
Mm. And you start the book with grouping liberal political thought in Iran into two categories. One of them is liberal antipathies, and the other one is liberal prescriptions. Could you tell us a bit more about these two rather broad categories and what each of them exactly entail? And I mean, what is it that links these two seemingly contrasting elements into a more or less cogent liberal project?
Yeah, another excellent question. I think when I was deciding as to how I was going to talk about the substance of liberalism in Iran over the course of the period that this book covers, roughly from the late 19th century to the beginning of the 21st century, it became very clear to me that I did not want to offer a singular essentialist liberal definition that would kind of capture this very long period and a whole range of different political thinkers that not only contained deep contradictions between them, but also even within their own individual thoughts as well. So I thought the best way to divide this, and I again, the example here that really helped me was the work of Alan Ryan, political philosopher Alan Ryan, who in his book on the making of modern liberalism really talks about the liberal project as being defined by a set of antipathies and prescriptions. Liberals are always against something and for something in place of it. So that's how I think of antipathies and prescriptions. The things that Iranian liberals over that time period can be said to be against, and I identify three antipathies here: anti-traditionalism, anti-absolutism, and anti-imperialism. And the things that Iranian liberals are for or have shared the common project on. And these are liberal nationalism, constitutionalism, and pluralism. Although this is a kind of a neat topology, there are many other categories that one could think of. I wanted to especially think about three broad subcategories under antipathies and prescriptions that would encapsulate a whole range of other antipathies and a whole range of other prescriptions. But as a starting point in this inquiry, I wanted also to maintain analytical clarity and not really, you know, offer 15 or 20 different antipathies. And I, you know, hope that this kind of classification would be useful for future researchers who want to actually elaborate on these specific antipathies. But as a starting point in understanding liberalism in Iran, it's struck me that especially the first generation of what could be classified as liberal political thinkers in Iran were especially keen on pushing against the decadence, corruptions, and really the traditional culture that was that they found to be really constraining and claustrophobic in the mid to late 19th century. This cohort of intellectuals that I outline in chapter two were especially interested in modernizing Iran in the same fashion as the modernizers in the Ottoman court at that time, which the Iranian intellectuals really look up to as the kinds of reforms and programs that could really rescue Iran out of its traditionalist, decadent position vis-a-vis other regional powers and especially Western European powers. Within the Ottoman court itself, I should say, those reformers who were working on the Tanzimat, it was called, they were looking to the Europeans. They were trying to imitate many of the constitutional principles and philosophies that were very in vogue in European capitals, as Paris and London, especially in post-Enlightenment Europe. And they wanted to kind of import those wholesale into administering Ottoman law and especially Ottoman governance. So there was this kind of ripple effect from the West already that was reaching Iran in the manner of anti-traditionalist antipathies. And here, really, the main kind of first spark was to transform Iranian culture and to move it away from, even at the level of the alphabet, to something that more closely resembled modern, westernized ways of discourse, of organization, and of thinking about the relationship between the rulers and the ruled. And this leads to the second antipathy of anti-absolutism, which, as the name suggests, was really geared toward ending the arbitrary rule of hereditary rulers who were oftentimes ill-equipped to not only glean what people under them really needed for the society to be transformed along those modern projects, but also especially to introduce efficiency and accountability in matters of governance. And this anti-absolutist antipathy is something that exists to this day. Unaccountable power is something that liberals hate with passion more than anything else. The rule of law, qanun, as Iranian liberals of the time who really championed, especially in the anti-absolutist vein, the reforms that were needed to bring Iran into the community of modern states, thinkers like Mirza Malcolm Khan, for instance, or Mirza Fath Ali Akhundzadeh, Muhammad Agha Khan Kermani, et cetera, they were really interested in focusing on the establishment of the rule of law and of checks and balances in matters of governance. And then the last antipathy, and this was something that was not apparent so much at the time of the late 19th century, it would come much later as Iran's dependence on Western powers become clear to intellectuals as a key obstacle to true reform and the development of country into a modern nation state. So in the mid to late the 20th century, the second half of the 20th century, really, that antipathy is anti-imperialism. To restrict as much as possible foreign meddling in Iran's internal affairs and to really advocate for Iran's independence. Going to prescriptions, I don't have to say much here because the prescriptions are meant to be remedies to those antipathies. So you have constitutionalism, which is meant to be as a remedy to absolutism and to the problem of absolutism and traditionalism. The constitutional revolution of 1905 to 1911 is probably the single most important development in this regard, in that it features those antipathies channeled into actual political prescriptions in the realization of constitutional documents and constitutional government. However, kind of tenuous and feeble and short-lived that experiment was, it nevertheless was a very important development. Similarly, liberal nationalism is a particular prescription meant to be a counter to the problem of imperialism. And here, I mean, we can talk about this more later, but I say liberal nationalism because nationalism as a project is something that actually is championed by a variety of other ideologies as well. Socialists / communists, traditionalists, the religious clergy, for instance, they all championed the cause of nationalism and Iran's independence, but they put the emphasis in not so much constitutional government, but in what they what was their particular normative political agenda. So for the religious nationalist, it was Sharia-based independent government. And for the socialist, it was not liberal constitutionalism, but to make a very complicated political scheme simple, a variant of social democracy. Even communist one-party rule in the more extreme manifestations of the Tudor party, for instance, in Iran. So liberal nationalism was different in that it really focused on constitutional government, but also constitutional government that was especially bound by international law and norms of human rights that were emerging in the second half of the 20th century. Probably the most well-known avatar of liberal nationalism is the Iranian Prime Minister Mohammad Mossadegh, who obviously is very well known to Western audiences for having been deposed through a CIA MI6 sponsored coup that brought back the a monarchy into Iran after brief experimentation with parliamentary representation, not necessarily parliamentary democracy, but parliamentary representation. But there are other important liberal nationalists, Mohammad Ali Farouqi, for instance, another Iranian prime minister, precursor to Mossadegh, I think was even more important in this regard because he not only focused on the political project of ensuring Iran's resources remained independent and in the hands of Iranian politicians and that Iran was recognized as a sovereign nation state. But domestically, at a cultural level, Farouqi was absolutely key in working on establishing, institutionalizing domestic public spaces and cultural spaces where a sense of Iranian national liberality could come into being, where the arts, Iranian arts and crafts could be made discernible to the lay public, where coherent and substantive curriculum at all levels of education could be truly Iranian and not a simple imitation of Western curricula, for instance. And Farouqi, who was instrumental in creating a lot of cultural and political institutions domestically to really bring a great deal of substance to this liberal nationalist project, is really in many respects the hero of liberal nationalism. The last prescription, pluralism, is something that comes much later. And it's really, I say in the book, to me, a response not so much to the depredations of the 20th century that many countries around the world experienced, the question of, you know, decolonization, of independence, of building a modern economy, modern political institutions, the liberation of women, etc., but rather a direct response to the advent of theocracy in Iran after the 79 revolution. Pluralism is probably the latest liberal prescription that found a special resonance in the works of intellectuals, of reform-minded intellectuals, but also non-regime or non-reform affiliated intellectuals who are really interested in presenting other perspectives alongside kind of Islamic reformist perspectives for making the state more democratic, creating a space for secular, non-religious perspectives. And that pluralist project is something that itself is a kind of a manifestation of a late liberal Western development that many multicultural Western societies, for instance, were having conversations around as well. Canada, where I grew up, for instance, the question of multicultural citizenship in the works of liberal theorist Will Kimlicka, for instance, in the 90s, was something that was trying to really come to terms with how best to account for the diversity of ethnic backgrounds, religious backgrounds, linguistic backgrounds, as well as perspectives in a diverse liberal society that would not result into conflict, into violence. Well, there was a variant of that taking place in Iran too, but here it was really deliberately meant to push away the kind of the centrality of the Islamic reformist agenda that was trying to make the Islamic Republic more democratic. So broadly, those are the kind of the six categories that I divide into three antipathies and three prescriptions during the course of the last century or so in Iran.
But the question that comes to mind here is that how did this, you know, hidden liberalism come into being in the first place in Iran? I mean, what did necessitate it, if you like?
Yeah, I mean, maybe it's good for me to say something about what I mean by hidden liberalism, since I've talked about liberalism and liberalism in Iran looking a certain way. Hidden liberalism, I mean, this is a concept that that kind of came to me as I was reading a lot of primary source documents, speeches, memoirs, translations of Western works of Western liberal thought, you know, from the late 19th century all the way to the reform period at the end of the 20th century in Iran, for instance. What I found noticeable across all these works spanning a century was the way in which intellectuals and political thinkers seem to go out of their way to dissociate themselves from the Western liberal affiliations and ideologies, while substantively communicating those ideologies wholesale. I kind of made a note about this, that it was interesting that on the one hand, they seem to go out of their way to say we're not liberals, or depicting the kinds of political projects, these antipathies and prescriptions that they were championing, as something that was just in the national interest, or that it was native to Iran even. But in fact, the substance was liberal. It was at the end of the day about the preservation of those kind of very kind of loosely articulated essence of the liberal project, you know, unencumbered self-expression, toleration, accountability, reason over fanaticism and passions, modernity over tradition, et cetera, et cetera. And so it became clear to me that liberalism was almost a taboo as subject matter, because it would very quickly disqualify the person, the intellectual, the political thinker, the political reformer, as a plaything of Western imperialism. And while I was writing this book, I was also reading a great deal about Indian intellectuals, Indian liberals in post-Raj India, and it was striking to me how they were behaving in the same way as well, how Turkic intellectuals in the immediate kind of post-Ottoman period will also be Egyptian intellectuals. Albert Hourani has a wonderful book called The Liberal Age about the Arab world, in which he also kind of points out that, you know, the way to understand the liberal substance of many intellectuals in mid-19th century to mid-20th century in the Arab world is to really always read between the lines and to kind of undo the political doublespeak of intellectuals. So it became very clear to me that actually these liberalism was deliberately being avoided as a label and as a marker of political affiliation, but that it was also most effective when that label was avoided in that way. And so hidden liberalism, I call it the judicious thought practice of liberalism, of liberalism in a manner that it would be unfamiliar to its would-be opponents. It's a way of being liberal without making it easy for your opponents to label you as such. And that kind of behavior seemed to me, that kind of thought practice, seemed to me to be apparent in many post-colonial and semi-colonial societies. And here, I kind of explain in the book that hidden liberalism really speaks to a dual burden of responsibility on liberal intellectuals. On the one hand, they have to assert liberal principles against the existing regime. So they want, you know, greater freedoms, they want more accountability, they want more toleration, they want a relatively open public space where equal respect can be observed. They want the rule of law, et cetera. But at the same time, they have to be mindful of the ways in which that regime, that society, that state has been disfigured by the influence of Western imperialism, which oftentimes was liberal imperialism in the late 19th century and early 20th century, so that they could not, in fact, be seen as doing the same work of liberal intellectuals, albeit now in a non-oppressive, progressive way. And so that dual burden, I think, is in the DNA of hidden liberalism, is to assert liberal rights against the state, but also always be mindful of the fact that the state is disfigured by the legacy of liberal Western imperialism. And therefore, that I call hidden liberalism, perhaps one of the most effective variants of liberalism, in that it is self-reflexive from the beginning. It is always taking account of its own origins. It is aware of what practically works and doesn't, what would be in the greater interest of liberal principles progressing in a society, the kind of language that is kind of very avowedly or publicly liberal versus the kind of language that it is avowedly and publicly about very local concerns, that it doesn't attach itself to those ideologies so proudly. In many respects, I think the relative success at a substantive level of the liberal project during the course of Iran's political development in the last century or so, compared to that of, let's say, socialism, I think owes to that hiddenness that liberals have employed. I think many post-colonial societies, many semi-colonial societies have been able to internalize liberal norms and practices. And you see it in protests against the state, for instance, so much more successfully than socialist practices, because socialism or communism had a very publicly avowed, very doctrinaire, unapologetically kind of pro-Soviet in the context of the second half of the 20th century. Affiliations that those intellectuals associated with them openly proclaimed. Liberals didn't have that. And I think that accounted both for their failings, but also for their kind of long-term success in in having these values kind of seep in more in the society.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Do you have a point of sale system you can trust, or is it a real POS? You need Shopify for retail. From accepting payments to managing inventory, Shopify POS has everything you need to sell in person. Go to shopify.com/system, all lowercase, to take your retail business to the next level today. That's shopify.com/system.
Mm. And going back to something you mentioned very briefly earlier, Hossein, how did these liberal political thought manifest after the Iranian Revolution in 1979?
Yeah, it's a very curious thing, because unlike other post-colonial societies, or many of them anyway, Iran experienced a massive upheaval in the form of the 79 revolution that overthrew a secular hereditary monarchy that was a modernizing force in Iranian politics, and replaced it with not a kind of constitutional government that had been championed by liberals and nationalists of different sorts, but by a religious form of government, a theocracy, an Islamic theocracy. And hidden liberalism after the revolution becomes even more entrenched in a way, because whereas before, under the Pahlavi regime, its chief antipathy was absolutism, and it had to kind of hide itself in ways that did not appear as threatening to the arbitrary power of this principle of hereditary monarchy. After the revolution, it had to situate itself against a system that had religion as the basis of the constitution of the state, but also a kind of religious absolutism that did not allow for the kinds of traditional reform approaches that were undertaken under the Pahlavi regime. I say in the chapter that covers this period that really the lineage of liberalism in the second half of the 20th century cannot be understood without the lineage of anti-liberalism in that same period. And anti-liberalism is really the singular, most coherent antipathy, if you will, of the Islamic Republic regime after the revolution. Whereas under the Shah, it was not necessarily anti-liberalism that defined the ideologies of the Pahlavi monarchy. The Pahlavi monarchy ideology was about modernity and progress. It was modern progress that really drove, and authoritarian liberalism is something that they employed, you know, liberalizing the curriculum. The 1963 White Revolution programs of the Shah, for instance, were meant to liberalize curricula, make women prominent participants in society, liberalizing and relaxing cultural norms, pushing back against religion and traditionalist ways of living in Iran. You know, I joke that, you know, women went from being beaten for wearing the hijab under the Pahlavis to being beaten for not wearing the hijab after the revolution. That tells you, as facetious as that example may seem, it tells you about the essence of the antipathy of those two regimes. The antipathy of the Pahlavi era was anti-traditionalism and authoritarian, progressive, authoritarian liberal approaches were thought to be the prescription. And that forced liberals to behave accordingly. After the revolution, the antipathy of the Islamic Republic really is this anti-Western modernity, and especially anti-liberalism. That is something that is very much in the air, I should say, in the kind of variety of third worldist liberation movements in many post-colonial societies. Political Islam also in this period is becoming so much more organized and known as an effective mobilization force against anti-Westernism in those societies. And so Iran experiences the first successful Islamist revolution anywhere in the world that takes over a modern state. And the antipathy of the state is really anti-Western liberalism. And so liberals are even more beleaguered, more challenged, especially in that first decade after the revolution. That's a decade in which I was really brought up in Iran. And I saw this in the literal change in school curricula, how our books change, how the teaching of, you know, even evolution was taken out of the books. Every book had the beginning of it, Quranic injunctions, and you know, the school day started with recitation of kind of pledges of loyalty to the Islamic Republic, to the ways of it, kind of a devout and faithful way of life, and its opposite, kind of grievance and anger against kind of everything from atheistic Soviet communism to the kind of overly materialist, licentious liberalism and the materiality of Western countries, etc. So liberals in this environment had to really lower their expectations. The Pahlavi era paradoxically brought a lot of progress for liberal-minded intellectuals. That's why a lot of them were in the royal court, even. After the revolution, all of those advantages went away. And here, the progress was now measured into how best you could create very small private spaces of self and collective enjoyment, to be able to read banned books, to listen to banned music. And I should emphasize, this is the first decade after the revolution, roughly, I'm talking about. After in the second and third decades, especially after the advent of the reform movement, that society generationally changes, and those spaces become much more enlarged, and the zones of confrontation move elsewhere. But hidden liberalism in that post-revolutionary period now became so much more concerned with the project of preserving and furthering a pluralist public space, to always pushing back against the monistic essence of the Islamic constitutionalist system in Iran, which had as a single source of the good, really Islam the Sharia as a system of its laws. Pluralism here meant always emphasizing that there are a multiplicity of ways to a good life, that toleration of multiple perspectives, that toleration of diversity and different ways of living is very important. And creating and preserving that space really becomes a task of liberal-minded intellectuals and reformers in this period. And it is, for that reason, very limited, very slow, because the state is so much more repressive. And many of them, this is the great decade of the brain drain in Iran, many of them start to really leave the country and go to Western societies where they could actually live their lives in, without fear of kind of arbitrary detentions, daily harassments, et cetera. And my own family and myself are part of that kind of flight from the country as well.
Mm. As the last question about the book, Hossein, you have looked at hidden liberalism with a focus on the Iranian context, right? But is there any sort of implications of hidden liberalism for the study of liberal thought practices in other non-Western post-colonial settings and more broadly in the global context?
I hope so. I mean, one of the things that I emphasize in a book, which, again, it struck me when I started looking into this more and more, I use this phrase that Western political theory has a visibility bias when it comes to understanding and seeing liberal thought practices outside of the West. If it doesn't look exactly as how liberal arguments and liberal practices were engaged with in Western societies, then they don't tend to see it. So hidden liberalism, this is a double meaning of the term, is really hidden to them, to Western political theorists. And this is a real big problem, especially since the frontiers of liberal research and intellectual thinking are in the Western Academy. That variant of liberal thought practice is completely looked over. Now, since the kind of for the last 15 years or so, there has been a little tiny space opened, what's called comparative political theory, in Western universities, where kind of localized, contextualized practices of Western ideologies outside the West are being more and more paid attention to. What I hope that those who read this book and look at the example of Iran can gain in terms of thinking about variants of liberalism elsewhere is to first and foremost understand that liberal antipathies and prescriptions may look different in their own contexts, to be able to map out and chart how it is that the kind of inevitably necessarily dialectical process between native intellectuals and Western intellectuals looks like in particular countries, and to be able to then juxtapose that inquiry onto the political development of a particular society or state. To what extent has either the state succeeded in pushing that ideology out to a point where even its hidden manifestation doesn't matter, or the reverse, as in the case of Iran, for instance, that the state society dynamic is lively enough that the society is always pushing back against the state by very successfully camouflaging its progressive development, even under the cloak of, or under the thumping weight, let's say, of authoritarian practices of the state, that the society continuously finds zones of self-reflection, of open and tolerant engagement, and that these liberal norms find deeper roots that over time can really challenge the authoritarian practices of the state. So it strikes me that this visibility bias has to be pushed back against in especially Western academy first and foremost, and this book is really an attempt to do that more than anything else. And secondly, to, I think, rather than kind of take it for granted that these ideologies are Westernized or that have no meaning or discernible lineage in non-Western settings, to go and investigate to see whether that in fact is the case or not. And I was surprised. I started off very ignorant about whether in fact liberalism was alien to Iran or not. And as I started reading these memoirs and notebooks and political tracts from the middle of the 19th century to today, I was astonished by how engaged Iranian intellectuals and political figures were with works of Western thought and how they were contemplating among themselves, either in private or publicly, in private through all sorts of secret societies in the late 19th century, for instance, and later on through kind of private gatherings, to try to figure out what the kind of localized, rooted, native perspective on these ideologies from the West would look like, and I was very surprised to find that there was a great deal to write and talk about there.
Thank you, Hossein. There's obviously a lot more in the book, and I encourage listeners to pick up a copy. But before we wrap up the interview, I'd like to ask whether you're working on something right now, Hussein, or are you thinking about doing a research on a particular topic in the near future?
Yeah, I've become very interested as a result of this book. This is the kind of project I'm pursuing right now, on the relationship between liberal legitimacy and enmity, the whole topic of antipathies and liberal thought really got me interested in, first of all, how poorly liberalism seems to take account of enmity, social enmity between different groups, different ideologies, and how that seems to actually be a central challenge to principles of liberal political legitimacy. And I'm working on, this is more abstract. It doesn't have anything to do with Iran. It's just that the liberal theory itself, liberalism seems to place a high premium on the moral principle of equal respect between persons, between individuals. And in this regard, equal respect is something that is fundamental to the comprehensive view of liberalism. And you find this in Rawls, you find this in Charles Lamer, you find this in Ronald Dworkin, and a variety of other liberal thinkers and practitioners' works. But it strikes me that actually the principle of equal respect for persons is something that continuously undermined by enmity in society. In other words, oftentimes people have very good reasons to not only hate someone or hate an ideology, but to really act on those feelings. And those reasons are kind of dismissed offhand by liberal thinkers as being unreasonable, as things that are outside the bounds of a good, decent society. So I'm trying to kind of work through this and figure out why it is that this kind of insistence that's, that liberals have that these views are necessarily unreasonable actually ends up undermining a lot of liberal principles itself. So that's one project. And enmity is, as a whole, a big project that after I'm done with this short article on liberalism and enmity, I'm going to turn to. I'm interested in the sources of enmity and how as a social political force, it seems to define political ideologies and theorizing about those ideologies so much more powerfully than other factors that are material factors that are oftentimes talked about, social class, for instance, or identity being one. So those are the projects that I'm working on right now.
Both sound really exciting and thought-provoking, and hopefully we can talk about it again on this very podcast whenever it comes
love
out. Do you have any further comments before saying goodbye, Hussein?
No, I wish to thank you for this opportunity, for these very sharp, crisp questions, for me to be able to talk about this book, to talk about the case of Iran. And I hope your listeners and fellow political theorists see a value in checking some of these arguments out.
I'm sure they will. And it's me who should thank you for coming on the show, speaking with me today and sharing your insight and your wonderful work with our listeners. I really enjoyed reading the book, but I enjoyed it even more to talk about it with you today. So thank you for that.
Thank you very much, Amir John.